Now, the story of a real-life Amazon explorer, the great 19th-century British naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace, the co-discoverer with Charles Darwin of the theory of natural selection. Unlike the aristocratic Darwin, Wallace always had to make a living, and he did so by collecting animal specimens in far-flung places, like the Amazon River Basin, and then selling them to museums and wealthy collectors. His fieldwork, first in the Amazon and later in the Malay Archipelago, gave him the raw data to formulate his theory of evolution. But his work often came at a cost. One night, in 1852, while working in the Amazon, he overheard his porters plotting to kill him and steal his possessions. Wallace managed to escape, but later nearly died when his ship back to England caught fire and sank. Today, Alfred Russel Wallace remains a mysterious figure, unlike the more famous Darwin. Historian James Moore has long been fascinated by Wallace. He stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
Now, we should elaborate on the different backgrounds of Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, the two co-discoverers of the theory of evolution. Darwin grew up a gentleman, grew up with a certain aristocratic background, with privilege, went to good schools, didn't have to work for a living as he was laboring away on his great theory. Wallace had none of that. In fact, he had to make a living all the way to the very end, even once he was famous.
Darwin was to the manner born, you might say, the scion of rich doctors. Wallace was the son of an impoverished lawyer who made some bad investments and may have gambled. He had to leave school at the age of 13 or 14 and find work. And Wallace became really quite adept at what he did. He helped build boats. He helped build houses. Then he got a break to go abroad and collect for a living.
Collect specimens.
Yes, insects, for example, for rich collectors. And he developed a real taste for natural history and for finding out where rare species live.
And his first great expedition was to go down to South America, to Brazil, to the Amazon, which, of course, as we know, is one of the richest repositories of life on Earth.
Indeed, he was in South America for 4 or 5 years, and unfortunately, there was a fire aboard the ship on which he was returning to England, and all his specimens were destroyed, almost all of them. And
So this is how he was going to make his living. Suddenly, it was all gone.
Suddenly, it was gone. He had some scraps, and he had some papers, and he was adrift in a lifeboat, and he was finally picked up and delivered back in London. And typical Wallace, he just turned right back around. Within 2 years, he was off again to what is today Indonesia. And he spent 8 years there, traveling about with the ordinary people who live there, making friends with them, picking up the language, picking up the species, and sending them back. And at one stage, he was a supplier to Charles Darwin, who complained about the amount of carriage it was costing for these ducks or whatever to be sent back from Bali and Lombok, where Wallace was exploring. But while he's out there, he also is thinking geographically. That's how he thought. He had a mappy mentality. He was drawing lines saying these things live here, these things live there. This is how they make a living. And he discovered this famous biogeographic boundary called Wallace's line, where you have the placental mammals coming up from the west, stopping, and the marsupials continue on the east. And that is a major phenomenon in the history of life on Earth.
Part of what is so fascinating about the story is that Wallace was 7,000 miles away from England when he came up with this understanding of what came to be known as the theory of evolution, whereas Darwin was doing the same thing across the world, basically coming up with the same idea roughly at the same time.
Remember, Wallace started out his career as a collector, believing in evolution. He started out because he thought it was a good idea, not because he had the evidence for it. What he lacked was a convincing theory. So unlike Darwin, he jumped to conclusions very readily, did Wallace. What he discovered, or rather I should say formulated when he was in the Far East, was what he called a principle. He didn't call it natural selection because he didn't believe that selection really was going on. He believed that adjustments were being made in nature as animals varied slightly from generation to generation, and some were fitter than others to survive. It looked very much like Darwin's theory. And when Darwin first read a statement of it, Darwin said, yeah, it's my theory. But now we realize that Darwin read in haste, and there are significant differences in what Wallace came up with, 7,000 miles and half the Earth away from what Darwin came up with. They were inspired by the same thinker, Thomas Robert Malthus, who talked about how population increases much faster than the food supply can increase. And this was a struggle that Wallace was familiar with in a human context. And when he was in the Far East, he saw how humans struggled amongst themselves and with each other for the limited amount of food. At the same time, he recognized that animals must struggle even more because their populations really do explode. And this led to the principle of survival. So they were close, but it wasn't ultimately the same theory.
Hmm. Now, there was a momentous coming together of these two men. As you said, Wallace knew Darwin, in fact, supplied Darwin with specimens, then sent Darwin a letter outlining his theory. And Darwin had been working on this theory for 20-some years. Can you describe what we know about Darwin's reaction?
Well, Darwin was flabbergasted. We don't have that original letter today. We don't know exactly what Wallace said to Darwin, but we do have the statement of his theory. Darwin, with help from his friends, was able to claim priority for what he regarded as the same theory, only he'd got there first.
There's always been some question about whether Darwin acted unethically here.
Yes, and there always will be because a lot of the evidence seems to be missing and people say that's part of the conspiracy. I don't think it is really. But Wallace, after all, was not the professional gentleman whom Darwin and his friends were. Wallace was a kind of person who could be taken advantage of and would be grateful for the opportunity to be associated with people like Darwin. And sure enough, when Wallace heard about the arrangement and that he had been published by the great, and he was great, Charles Darwin at this time, he was full of gratitude and was fine. He was pleased to defer to Darwin for the rest of his life, even when they disagreed. It was the sort of guy he was. He was really quite a likable fellow. And he was always playing second fiddle in a way to Darwin, and Darwin grew more and more to distrust Wallace's scientific judgment. He says so.
Well, why was that?
And Wallace got into all kinds of things because he was easily led or easily convinced. He got into evolution. He got into something called mesmerism, which we now call hypnotism. He got into phrenology. That's the science of bumps on the head, telling what kind of person you really are. He got into spiritualism, table turning, all kinds of things that spooky today, but
he went to seances, right?
Yeah, he was. You know, he saw things that he believed were miracles. There was some higher power causing them, he believed, and he believed that people like Darwin should be interested in it. I mean, Darwin went to a seance, and before the fireworks started, he said, "I've got a headache," and he went upstairs. You know, so Darwin really never sat through it, and his wife said, "He really doesn't want to believe it." There's probably some truth in that. I don't think she believed it either. It was a good show. But Wallace took these things seriously. Other people thought it was a parlor game. And that was typical of Wallace. He latched onto things. Later he latches onto socialism and women's liberation, all kinds of things that we don't have such a problem with today. But Darwin thought it was just dotty of the guy and typical of him.
The other thing that Wallace did is he seemed to come to believe, maybe he had always believed this, that human beings were set apart from the story of evolution to some degree, at least the development of the human mind.
From an early age, let's say around 20, that would be the early 1840s, Wallace was convinced that our brains have enormous unknown powers. He saw that first in what you and I understand as hypnotism, which is a bit spooky until you understand how the brain works. But Wallace didn't understand how the brain works, but he assumed that it could do things that we now know can't be done, like moving tables. Only Wallace came to believe that there was a whole world of personal spirits out there working together with us, and it was to those spirits we would go in the afterlife. This was becoming an orthodox fringe belief in America and Britain in the middle of the 19th century. Wallace took it up, but at that time it wasn't clear what was going to become science and what wasn't science. These boundaries were porous and they were ill-defined. So looking at it from the point of view of Wallace in his own time, you can't be sure what the outcome will be. But Darwin and his lot, you know, they weren't sure either, but they knew which side was progress, and progress was on the side of no miracles.
And yet also it would seem that perhaps Wallace was inherently more of an egalitarian than Darwin was.
Many of the problems between Darwin and Wallace stem from their social origins. You know, as I like to put it, Wallace had dirt under his fingers. Darwin kept his hands clean. Wallace may have bathed every week or two. Darwin probably bathed every day or two. Darwin had the means to live in the country. He never had to work a day in his life. Wallace had always to work by the sweat of his brow.
Even after he was famous? Even after it became well known that he was the co-discoverer
of the theory
of evolution?
He lived from pen to mouth. Darwin never had to write a word in his life to live off of his investments from his father. He owned two farms. He was an absentee landlord. Wallace could barely afford to build his own house, and he only had two children, and he had to sell that house in order to find schooling for them, and he moved from place to place, and for fun he grew up plants, but the rest of the time he spent marking exam papers.
Now, today, we associate Charles Darwin with the discovery of the theory of evolution. I mean, it often goes by the word Darwinism. Wallace certainly isn't forgotten, but he is definitely the lesser figure here. Has he gotten a raw deal in history?
Many people think Wallace has got a raw deal. Many people think that the power of Darwin and his friends in the establishment has marginalized him. Wallace was always marginal.
Because of Wallace's interest in spiritualism?
Because of Wallace's interest in spiritualism and other things that were considered to be disproven or unscientific or anti-scientific. Wallace also believed things passionately that we believe today. He believed that humankind was destroying valuable so-called primitive cultures, that natural habitats were being wasted by rapacious industry, whereas Darwin saw this as an example of progress. The elimination of species, the simplification of habitats, the predominance of the Caucasian race, the loss of anthropomorphous apes, as he called them, this would be a sign that humanity is rising. For Wallace, humanity was falling. Wallace is admirable, although he was obstinate and opinionated, he is admirable because he persisted, undaunted, in the face of formidable opposition to hold his own views. And of course, he died, remembered very fondly by many people who still regarded themselves as outsiders.
James Moore is a historian of science at the Open University in England and co-author of a major biography of Charles Darwin. He spoke with Steve Paulson.